welcome to this week's edition of History Now. I'm delighted to welcome Professor Richard Grayson from Goldsmiths, University of London, who's going to be speaking to us about his new digital online project, Geography of Service and Death, a study of the East and West Belfast UVF who enlisted in World War I. Richard, you're very welcome.
Thank you.
Just come here straight from Prony, where there was a symposium on the First World War.
It was looking particularly at the digital history of the First World War, so how we can take the stories and put them in new forms and also preserve them for future generations.
Yeah, how did that go then?
It was good, yeah. There's a good discussion. I think one of the challenges that's facing all the really great community projects that have been developed during the war is just making sure that they are kept for the future. It's got so easy to set up a website now. All you have to do is forget to pay the annual subscription and it can be lost. So there are organisations looking at how best to archive the centenary work that was done in 2014 to 2018.
This current project that you have, it's called Geography of Service and Death.
Yeah.
We're over here to discuss that with...
Yes, I was partly there talking to local people who happened to come in. There was a session in the morning that was various projects showcasing their work. And then I was just taking part in the discussion in the afternoon. Lessons from that, but also other centenary projects I've been involved with. For example, the Imperial War Museum's Lives of the First World War project, which is one of the big national things that happened during the centenary.
Yeah. So this particular one, I know you're working with one of our local historians here, Jason. So can you tell us how that came about?
I've been working with Jason Burke, who's a local historian. Lots of people have probably been on his walking tours that he does connected to the history of East Belfast. I published a book called Belfast Boys in 2009, which was about West Belfast, and used a method I called military history from the street, where you try to get as much data as possible for everybody from a local area who served. And having looked at that project and that publication, Jason thought, well, could I do the same for East Belfast? So his East Belfast and the Great War project sought to gather in information on everyone in East Belfast. And we both ended up with several thousand names on a database. It's not possible to publish all of those in a list that's user friendly. But I think we were both struck by how the story of the UVF members who enlisted in the British Army is told in a particular way, and the way it's told is that those men joined the Ulster Division in September 1914, they trained for a year or so, they were deployed to France, they were then in action on the Somme when they had very heavy fatalities, and you don't really hear much about the rest of the story, whether that's Messines when they were with the 16th Division, or at Passchendaele later, or during the German Spring Offensive in 1918. We knew from that data that a story that emphasised the fact that men from the UVF had joined the Ulster Division and fought on the Somme was actually missing out a lot of UVF members who had a very different story. So just take West Belfast. Around a third of men who were UVF members who served in the British military during the war were never in the Ulster Division for various reasons, which we might come on to. But we were just keen to use our data for East and West Belfast to try and get across the idea that that story that you see on the murals now is only part of the story. There's a whole lot more to say.
Yeah. And piecing together that story, it's painstaking, because I can remember Jason doing it and holding, you know, events in local halls and stuff where people came in. Did you, was the same sort of methodology you used yourself?
Yeah, so I think actually Jason did rather more of that than I did, because he was able to build on my methods and then take them a step further, really. You know, just think about what else you might do. But just to give you some examples, the first thing that both of us would have had to do is use newspapers for every single day of the war. So Belfast has daily newspapers during the war. That's a lot of newspapers to go through. And the newspapers are actually the main way in which you can find out which men were in the UVF. If you take some areas outside Belfast, if you take Lurgan as an example, which I know through family connections, they published in late 1914 a listing of UVF members in the Lurgan Mail who had joined the services, whether they'd been called up as reservists or had volunteered. That never happened for the Belfast units. So we have to piece it together. And the way you piece together UVF service is by looking at stories in newspapers about men who did something that was remarkable, or were killed, or were wounded, and then there'd be a little piece about them in the paper, and it would say they were a member of West Belfast UVF Special Service Section, or Willowfield UVF, or what have you. So it's really, really painstaking work. And then what Jason was able to do, and we hope we can do more of with this project, is get at the information that is hidden away in people's drawers and people's attics, because there are some real gems there.
Yeah. So you mentioned the big nationwide project.
Lives of the First World War. Yes.
So this particular project, of course, it's you know, relevant to Belfast.
Yeah.
In what other ways would you say it's different than, say, the big national project?
The mapping is actually crucial. And the way that through the Living Legacies Centre at Queen's, it's possible to visualise the data. So you can look at the map, and you can apply various different criteria. So for example, if you wanted to look at people by occupation, where we know the occupation, you can select that and it'll show you who is a tradesman, who's a skilled engineer, who's unskilled, and so on. That won't come through the national project. We can do that for religion, we can do that for UVF unit, we can do it for date of death, where it will show you who died in which year. And that's a really good way of representing the idea that those who were killed, they're not all killed in 1916, yeah, for example. You know, they're killed earlier in the war in 14, if they're reservists who are, or regular soldiers, at Gallipoli in 15, if they're in the 10th Irish Division, and then later on in other episodes of the war.
Yeah. So if you just alluded there before about how, you know, on the murals it doesn't tell the full story.
Yeah.
How does this project bring that to the fore?
I think for a start, it just helps you realise, if we take the date of death, that the First World War is not simply about the Battle of the Somme. I think it's important we understand why the Somme is so important. Yeah, yeah. Take the Shankill, for example. The first 2 days of the Battle of the Somme are 0.1% of the days of the war. Yet on those 0.1% of the days of the war, 13% of all the men from the Shankill killed in the war are killed. So there's a huge cluster. And I entirely understand why, if people want to commemorate one event of the war and pick that above anything else, of course that's the Somme. Mm. But so that's 13% of the Shankills dead on just 2 days of the war. What about the other 87% who died? And when you just look at the visualisation of who's killed in 14 and 15, for example, I think that makes you think, well, okay, well, the Ulster Division wasn't deployed in 1914, or indeed for most of 1915, so where did those come from? That'll lead you to two stories as examples. One is story of the reservists, men who are the equivalent of today's Territorial Army. So they're in the UVF, they're at home, but they're ready to be called up as soon as war breaks out, and they get called into action. Now, those men go into largely the 1st and 2nd Royal Irish Rifles. And those UVF members find themselves serving side by side with other reservists from the Falls who had been in the Irish National Volunteers. Men they could have fought had there been the Civil War that they expected, or many people expected, might break out. The other story that geography of death, the chronology of death, will lead you to is the UVF men who were so keen to join up when war broke out, that they didn't wait for the Ulster Division to be formed. It took a month of negotiations between Edward Carson and the War Office to get approval for the Ulster Division. They joined the 10th Irish Division, which recruits across the island of Ireland, men from all sides of the political and religious divide, and they are deployed at Gallipoli in August 1915, 2 months before the Ulster Division is in France. So the UVF volunteers who are killed first, if you like, the people who are most keen to join up, they've nothing to do with the Somme or the Ulster Division. They're at Gallipoli in the 10th Division.
One thing that's really interesting, I was looking at the map, the interactive map earlier, that the geography of West Belfast, how we know it today.
Yes.
You know, all, you know, the blue dots that represent each person that signed up and died. What does that tell us about, you know, the lay of the land in West Belfast?
So if we think of the geography of it, first of all, it's important to remember, I mean, people in Belfast won't need telling this, but just imagine Belfast without the West Link cutting through. Now, the effect of the West Link was that there were working class terraced houses on the city centre side of the West Link, which were very much part of West Belfast in 1914. We wouldn't now think of those areas as being part of West Belfast because they're inside the West Link. So the scope of what was West Belfast stretched right into the edge of the city centre, really into the edge of the commercial area. Also, there are places, I'm thinking of the Donegal Road, for example, that we would now very much think of as being part of South Belfast. Mm-hmm. But the boundary of West Belfast you can think of as the railway line. Mm-hmm. Because those people who lived there, where they went to work and socialise was much more in the west of the city. Somewhere like what is now the Park Centre, right on the edge, actually, of the Falls, is the Belfast Celtic Ground. It's where Winston Churchill comes in 1912 to speak in favour of home rule, absolutely central to ideas of West Belfast. I think we also need to realise that there are areas that we would very much think of as West Belfast that are not formally or legally in the West, because the dividing line then as now of the West and the North was a line up the Shankill Road. So there are places like Agnes Street that you would think of as very much part of the Shankill, but they're in North Belfast. I included them in West Belfast because it seemed that the parliamentary division wasn't the most relevant thing. But nevertheless, when you look at the UVF units that the men were in, by and large, those south of the Shankill were, and in the Shankill, were in the West Belfast UVF unit. But those north of the Shankill Road were in the, and south of the Crumlin Road, were in the North Belfast UVF. So the geography has changed. The religious geography was also a little more mixed, mm-hmm. as well. So I've done a walking tour of West Belfast on a number of occasions talking about West Belfast UVF members. We start off in Cultureland, Broadway, which used to be Broadway Presbyterian, mm-hmm. Church, because there were Presbyterians in the Falls in reasonably large numbers. In fact, in 1911 in the census, nearly 20% of the population of Falls Ward was Protestant of one denomination or another. So that has really changed. Yeah.
So in relation to West Belfast, what were the occupations of the people who were signing up?
It was very much a working class area. If you look at the tags that we've used on the map, you can see that, you know, the white collar section, there's very few of those. Largely, people were working in linen mills and in the shipyards as well. So coming from both West and East Belfast for that, of course. And they've got a range of occupations. You've got the skilled engineers and carpenters and electricians, but also a lot of unskilled workers who just would have been using their strength. And those men disproportionately went into the infantry. if you had a skill, or if you'd worked with animals, for example, you were far more likely to go into the Royal Engineers or the Artillery, both of which are using horses, as is the Army Service Corps. If you were a baker and you enlisted, you spent 4 years baking bread in the Army Service Corps and cooking other things. So the Army did pay quite significant attention to what you had done before. And it was in your interest that they did so, because if you had a particular skill, you would be paid a little more for being in the engineers than being an infantryman.
Yeah, if we can just go back to the format you're using, an interactive map, it's very well laid out, and the instructions for someone who's not tech savvy like me have been good to follow.
That's good to hear.
Have you noticed how much this kind of digital history has taken off, and if the decade of centenaries that we're in has contributed to the popularity of that?
It has taken off because people are thinking about how you can represent data, but I think we're at the early stages of it, actually, because I think most people lack the expertise, say in local community projects, to get the information on a map. And I'm one of those people lacking that expertise, because, you know, I'm a historian, Jason's a historian, we've gathered our data together. And we've worked through Living Legacies at Queen's. They have the Centre for Data Digitisation and Analysis there. And they're the people with the GIS expertise, as it's called, to put it on a map. It's quite labour intensive. One of the questions is, well, why only do the UVF? Well, we've got around 400 former members of the UVF on that map. I have 8,500 West Belfast men in my database, but you've got to manually work out a position on a map for each address that you have. So that is quite tricky. And so there are ways of doing this, but it costs money. So I think that still what we're seeing by and large with local community projects is people doing the role of honour kind of project, where you list people rather than analyse it altogether, because it's hard. Yeah. And funding is limited for this kind of thing. I put in a couple of proposals 10 years ago now to do this project for the whole of Ulster, nine county Ulster, because the Belfast newspapers used to report what was happening in Cavan, Monaghan and Donegal at the time. But it, you know, for the various UK funding agencies didn't fund it. And I'm sure had they done so, it would have been of great interest to people here during the centenary.
Yeah, so, but as you say, it's in the early stages.
Yeah.
Would you be hopeful of those other 8,000 that you have in the database?
Hope so. And I just think that starting off with quite a small cohort, but one that is quite vivid in people's minds. You know, lots of people here are interested in the history of the UVF and what happened to those men during the war. I think if we can do some work around that for a couple of years, maybe, it will give us an opportunity to see, well, what is possible, and then try to expand that on a much wider basis. Obviously, the next thing to do would be the data we have for East and West Belfast for non-UVF people. But it would be nice if there were people out there who wanted to add in material for North and South Belfast. Yeah. And actually, that would be possible. You know, if you had a team of people, you could go through all the newspapers on a daily basis, and probably, you know, 6 months of research of a team of people giving one day a week would produce that information. So we could expand it.
The book that you took your data from came out in 2009.
That was 2009.
So that's 10 years.
Yeah.
You're gathering the information for how many years before
I began that? Work on the project in 2005. And I'm not able to do it full time because as an academic I have to teach and do admin. But I was probably spending in reality 2.5 to 3 days a week across those 4 years on that, and then just sat on the data for a while. Really, I did use it for an article in a book that I co-edited with Fergal McGarry at Queen's called Remembering 1916, and that's got a chapter in it just on the UVF. So if people are interested in reading more about that, that's something to follow up on.
So the best part of 14 years you began there. How exciting is it to see it, you know, that all that stuff that you've gathered together on this format?
It is very exciting. Since the Belfast book came out, my main project has been a book on Dublin, city and county. Obviously, no UVF members there, but they did have a thing called the Loyal Dublin Volunteers, which was similar, and that came out last year. So that's where a lot of the focus has been. But in the meantime, this UVF project has been ticking over, and it's really exciting to see it out there because it is innovative and hopefully will engage people in a history that they feel passionately about.
And when you see it on the map, on, you know, on this digital format, do you look at things now, you know, small things, and like from a different perspective when you see it in that different format?
Well, it raises a lot of questions for me because, let's say, for example, I mentioned earlier that broadly, men north of the Shankill Road were in the North Belfast UVF, and broadly those south of it were in the West Belfast UVF. You see outliers. So you'll see people who live in what you might think of as the wrong area, and it's south of the Shankill Road, they're in the North Belfast UVF. And you think, well, why? Well, there could be all sorts of reasons. Maybe they knew someone through work or through school or through a sports team. Maybe they had a relative in that unit. And that always raises questions in my mind about why people do things, why they join organisations, and why they choose to join one organisation rather than another. You know, you read, take the Troubles as an example, you read accounts, and why did someone join the UDA rather than the UVF? Mm. And it can, well, my cousin was in it. It'll be that kind of thing. And I think those things are interesting in a 1913-14 context. Frustratingly, as a historian, how will we find the answers to that? Mm. Well, we need more layers of data to add in. So ideally, I think a development of this kind of map would be to start putting in family connections, so you could draw lines. Because if you could suddenly put a line between someone in the North Belfast UVF who's in what's formerly North Belfast and someone who's in it from another area, that helps you to understand why people did things. So you'd get relationship networks developing. And I think that would be something interesting to do for the future. And GIS is capable of doing that.
At that point in Belfast history, you had a large influx of people coming into the industries. People from outside Belfast, are they represented on these maps?
So the approach I've taken with what I call military history from the street is that you have to be living in Belfast at the time you enlisted. But that does mean people who might have thought themselves not as natives are included. So to give you an example, Frank Todd, who is the very first member of the UVF from East Belfast to be killed in the war, he's killed in October 1914 on the Western Front. He was born in Portadown and I believe grew up there and then moved into Belfast later. So, but I felt you had to have some kind of standard for the community, which is, okay, you could have done it a different way, everyone born there, but then if you're born there and you've moved away, then you're living somewhere else. So let's say you're killed, the impact of that, it may be felt where you were born, but actually it's probably more felt where you're actually living. So the approach I took is that you have to be living there. You have to have a verified address of yourself, and if we can't find an address for the soldier, you will have a next of kin address. And in the absence of an address for the soldier, I've taken next of kin as being where they're from, if you like. One of the interesting things about this project is that it can help people to discover things that they didn't know about their families, and that maybe they'd got sucked into a particular myth of the war. So for example, as a child, my great uncle James Powell, who was from Lurgan, served in the 2nd Royal Irish Rifles. I was always told he was killed on the Somme. Because if you think about what's the dominant memory of the war for people here, it's to say, well, he was on the Somme. When I discovered he was killed in September 1915, I thought, okay, he was probably killed before the Battle of the Somme. And then I found he was buried in Belgium. I realised he wasn't killed on the Somme. But that was one of the earliest insights I had over 30 years ago now, when I first visited his grave, into how maybe the story you're told is not quite the way it is, and you need a bit more research. And yet other aspects of it were true, because my dad always said, I think my mother had other brothers who served on the Somme. But because they weren't killed, it was harder to find out. And we did eventually discover that, yes, her two other brothers, both in the Ulster Division, both served on the Somme. So there's still something of the truth there, but it's not quite the truth that it was initially told as family history.
Yeah. So the the site where the interactive map is, there's a bit of an appeal, you know, if anybody has information.
Yeah.
Perhaps people who are wanting to know more, maybe that this can fill in the gaps even. Where can they find this, and how can they contact
So the, on the when you first log on to the website, there's a story map which gives you a bit of background before you get onto the map itself. And at the end of that are my contact details, so people can write to me at Goldsmiths University of London, and the address is there, or they can email me, and the email address is there, r.grayson@gold.ac.uk. And the idea, they can put it in whatever format they want. We know that people are going to come up with all sorts of different information, so we didn't create an online form. We just thought, if people can get in touch, we'd be interested to see photos, which we can reuse and we can add to the site, and in that way the website can become some kind of online memorial to people, but also other bits of information, including family stories and what happened to them after the war. As far as possible, it would be great to have evidence for those. So otherwise you fall into the family story of he served on the Somme, and in fact he didn't, he was killed somewhere else. But we're well aware that there are family stories that are only oral histories, but really rigorous, and you can't document them in any other way. We'd be really interested to hear of those. You know, were people particular sportsmen or something like that? We'd love to add all of that to the site in due course.
Okay, thank you very much, Professor Richard Grayson. Thank you.
All right, thank you.